the Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Virginia.
Welcome to this virtual session of the Supreme Court of Virginia. I am Chief Justice S. Bernard Goodwin. The other justices of the court are also present, with Senior Justice Charles Russell sitting for Justice Donald Lemons. The audio of this virtual session is being live streamed on a link which can be accessed at vacourts.gov. Welcome, everyone. Ms. Clerk, please call the first case.
Cortez Rivas versus Commonwealth, Fernando Villarroel, Appellant's Counsel, A. Ann Lloyd, Assistant Attorney General, Appellee's Counsel.
Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Good morning. My name is Fernando Villarroel. May it please the court. On behalf of Mr. Julio Cortez Rivas, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Sure.
Justices of the Supreme Court, we come before you with a pretty, I think, clear issue on assignment of error that we raise, but interestingly enough, one that is a case of first impression here in the Commonwealth. And this deals specifically with the issue of confrontation post-Crawford as it relates to sort of the involvement specifically of an interpreter or an individual providing interpretation, translation services in a case. As the facts were pronounced in the briefs, this involved an investigation involving an allegation of sexual assault of a minor that was a delayed report. I think it's pretty clear based on the case law, and I think we can probably all agree that the statements that are at the heart of this issue would fall in line of being considered testimonial. They were an interview that involved Mr. Cortez Rivas, the Detective Loving, and the interpreter, the officer providing interpretation translation services at the time, Officer Gomez, was done during an investigation after several months, not in response to an ongoing emergency, in furtherance of something that was anticipated to properly be prosecuted at that time. So I
counsel,
think, it, yes,
counsel,
sir.
Can you help me with first a factual point? With the transcript that was prepared, was that ever moved into evidence? The transcript that was prepared later?
No,
okay.
It was not.
All right, I just wanted to confirm that. I didn't see it in the record. And the second thing is, what statements of Officer Gomez were actually introduced at trial, as opposed to statements by Detective Loving or statements from your client? What did Gomez say that the fact finder heard?
Your Honor, that's a great question, and I know that was raised in the reply in the brief by the Attorney General's office. Essentially, no statements were provided by Officer Gomez during the trial.
Let me stop you right there, because the Confrontation Clause is a right to be confronted with a witness. So that means you need a witness. You need testimonial statements that were given to the fact finder. If there weren't any, it may be a good policy to have this person here or whatever, but I'm struggling to figure out, if there's no testimonial statements of any kind provided, how the Confrontation Clause is triggered at all.
Understood. The heart of our argument is that what we have here is when a translator and interpreter is involved, it's a very nuanced sort of interaction. And what was provided was the statements, the supposed statements of Mr. Cortez Rivas, Detective Loving, by way of Officer Ventura at trial. And I wasn't trial counsel. I think trial counsel was attempting to elicit in his objection and in his argument subsequent to his objection was that there should have been an opportunity to cross-examine the original interpreter, because what you have here is you have a sort of a dynamic when someone is providing interpretation services, translation services, it's a very sort of subjective at times process. And we sort of brought up the issue, the comparative case of bull coming, and that was, and you're dealing with hard data in a situation like that. An individual providing translation services, unless it's a certified court interpreter, who you would think that there would be some uniformity in their qualifications and their processes and what they sort of have to do throughout the process of eliciting the interpretation properly, it can be subjective if there aren't. And so you have nuances, you have colloquialisms that are different by country, by region. And so what Officer Gomez may have interpreted for either Detective Loving or the Mr. Cortez Rivas could have been very different from what
counsel,
Officer Ventura was testifying
counsel,
about.
Counsel,
yes.
Hot. This is Justice
yes,
Powell.
Yes.
If Officer Ventura had been the person at the scene and appeared in court to testify, would we have an issue from your perspective?
No, Your Honor. I don't think so. I don't think so. I think the confrontation issue would have been resolved pretty straightforward if the interpreter, the individual interpreting at the time, would have been available at trial to testify and be allowed
so
to be confronted.
As I understand the facts, she listened to the tapes. I understand your position is that there may have been some technical difficulties with the tapes. She listened to the tapes. She reinterpreted, in essence, the answers and the questions, and she appeared in court to testify. So doesn't that remove the problem, if there is one, with Officer Gomez?
I think were it not for the technical issues that were brought up, I think it may have been a bit of a clearer answer to that. I think the technical difficulties that were brought up through the audio, I think magnifies the potential sort of difficult situation that this could arise in, and maybe further in other cases. What you have is an individual who reviewed audio who was not there and presumably was under a different sort of set of environmental sort of a different sort of environmental situation than the live interpreter was at the scene. And the live interpreter could have interpreted something differently, could have missed something, could have forgotten something, may have had an opportunity to observe something that only he would have known being live at the scene and involved.
Once you have access to the recording?
Right. But the situation.
So then you had let's say that's right. I mean, I entirely agree with you. Anyone who studied foreign literature or even done, gotten into things like Bible studies, with translation comes nuance, comes subtlety. I'm with you on that. But if that's a problem with the officer who did testify, then you have cross-examination there. And if it's a problem with Officer Gomez, then you have the right to compulsory process to bring him in and, possibly treat him as adverse if that's called for. So there's mutually complementary protections of confrontation for those who are witnesses, and then compulsory process if you want to produce evidence that contradicts. But unless they're a witness, I'm still struggling. I understand your point. It would be desirable, it would be helpful, whatever, but I'm still not there with you on the confrontation point. That I find that argument elusive.
Right. No, I understand, again, a situation where not being trial counsel, I think there are certain ways that could have been, that could have come up, that could have addressed this issue at trial, that may have sort of removed the confrontation argument out of it, or at least resolved it. But I think what we have here is I'm dealing with the case that, I had to observe and look through the record. And what I noticed was, based on sort of doing the research, post appointment, I noticed that it wasn't something that isn't necessarily agreed to among the circuits. It's acknowledged in both briefs that there's a split here. And I think it's important here to and a reason why I sort of hammered in on this issue, that it needs to be sort of clarified to what extent this is sort of a foundational issue that needs to be addressed by the highest court in the Commonwealth, or if it's something that needs, you know, that needs to be addressed on a case-by-case basis in the trial courts. Based on the research that we did, obviously it's a split, and it's a very important split, because you have something that could either be considered post-Crawford or sort of pre-Crawford, with no uniformity in terms of how to approach the issue of an interpreter who may not be present at trial. It would have been ideal for Officer Gomez to be there. I acknowledge that without necessarily conceding any other points. It would have been ideal for Officer Gomez to be there, however which way he would have been subpoenaed from either the Commonwealth attorney or the defense. But the issue was that he wasn't. And what happens to Mr. Cortez Rivas's constitutional rights if that's, you know, that situation played out? And so what you have here is very important, and the Commonwealth, the Attorney General's office sort of brought this up in terms of, well, okay, even if these points are conceded, it could be considered harmless error.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. May I interrupt you for a second?
Yes.
In response to Justice Powell's earlier question about Officer Ventura and the work that was done by that officer, I believe you said that absent the technical difficulties in the tape, that there would be, quote, a clear answer, end quote, to her question. What would that clear answer be?
I think in terms of response to that question, you have an issue where, and if an individual is not available for whatever purpose, you know, and you have an audio or a video or a recording, I think, you know, if the environmental factors are sort of a non-issue, I think you have an ability to say that you can confront that witness pursuant to what the case law has informed us post Crawford.
So what I'm driving at is apply the logic of what you just said to the question. The question was, how do we deal with Officer Ventura's role in this as a witness and a cross-examined witness? And I think the logical answer that you gave was, absent the technical difficulties, there would be a clear answer. So in this case, assuming there weren't technical difficulties, what would the clear answer be?
I think that the issue would be that officer that Mr. Cortez Rivas likely would have been able to confront Officer Ventura in properly with her view and review of the audio.
I'm not disagreeing with you at all, but I'm trying to follow the logic.
Right.
If that's true, if that's the clear answer, that means that the only issue that you have, even under your best argument, is the issue of where Ventura may not have been able to do something because of a technical problem with the tape. But every other aspect of the tape, there'd be no Crawford question on the table at all. Am I over interpreting your logic?
No, Justice Kelsey. I think what I was trying to get at is the issue of the technical difficulty sort of magnifies the potential issues we have here with confrontation and an individual who's not present at trial to be cross-examined. I know that I'm sort of coming down on my time here, so if it's okay with the justices, I'd like to reserve for the remaining time for my rebuttal.
All right. You have 1 minute and 59 seconds for a rebuttal. Commonwealth.
Good morning. May it please the court, Ann Lloyd on behalf of the Commonwealth. This court should affirm the decisions of the courts below because no testimonial statements by Officer Gomez were introduced against the defendant at trial, requiring confrontation of Officer Gomez. Indeed, this case does not present the question that the defendant is arguing here before the court. Namely, this court does not need to come down on one side of what the Commonwealth agrees is a split among the jurisdictions about whether an on-scene interpreter's statements about the defendant's statements are testimonial themselves. That case fundamentally does not present this question, as has already been kind of hit on by Justice McCullough and Justice Powell. And so for the Confrontation Clause to apply, there are a couple requirements. One, there has to be a declarant. That declarant must make an out-of-court statement. That statement must be testimonial. And then it must be introduced against the defendant at trial. We don't meet those state that requirement here because no statements by Officer Gomez were introduced. And now I'll just comment a little bit on the interaction we just had between Justice Kelsey and opposing counsel, because I do think that it's a significant one. I see opposing counsel's argument kind of changing from what was on brief. On brief, he has consistently asserted that no matter what, Officer Gomez must appear because his statements of translation are testimonial, whether or not his statements come in at trial. Now what I'm hearing instead is really an evidentiary question, not a constitutional question, where if the tape had been clear here and Officer Ventura had had an easier time translating, then we wouldn't have a confrontation issue. The only issue we have here is the quality of the tape. And so I think that's a pretty significant concession that I just would bring to the court's attention in part of our discussion, because if there's no confrontation issue, if the tape is clear, that means that we're back on we're not at de novo. We're at a different standard that's much more favorable to the Commonwealth because we're going to defer to the fact finder, which is the jury at trial. And so I would just point to one record statement for the court. Indeed, of course, Officer Ventura talks about her process of how she listened to this for 5 hours, even though it was only a 25-minute interview, because she really wanted to make sure and get it right. She had headphones. It was quiet where she was. She could hear it well. And of course, that's fodder for impeachment. The defense does a good job trying to make it sound like she couldn't hear this. But on page 186 of the appendix, it says, "Are you confident in the translations that you produced?" And she says, "Yes." And so just kind of summing this up here, if the argument on appeal is now that the problem is not the lack of Officer Gomez, the problem is the quality of the tape, I think that's decisive on this issue and the court can affirm on that basis. But just to respond to his arguments on brief as well, even though we kind of have a change here today, so the defendant wants to analogize this case to the Charles case out of the 11th Circuit, where a telephone translation service was used, and then that person did not appear at trial. The translator did not appear at trial. But what we have here is far more similar to the Curbelo case, also out of the 11th Circuit, which is different, unique because it discusses the Charles case and how Curbelo is different, where instead we had an independent verification of the translation. So there we had some transcripts of some phone intercepts of the defendant's conversations. A separate independent witness, a cooperator, testified that he had listened to them, that these were good transcripts. That's basically exactly what we have here, is Officer Ventura acting as an independent translator who was subject to confrontation about the quality of the tape, about the quality of her translation, about her qualifications, about whether she had any problem understanding the idiosyncrasies or idiom that the defendant was using. And of course, she could have been subject to confrontation about how well Officer Gomez did. But none of that was brought up really at trial. And so that what we have here instead of a Charles case is really what the Commonwealth sees as what was approved by the Supreme Court in Bull Cumming and Melendez-Diaz, where those are forensic cases where they explicitly approved a separate forensic scientist coming in and retesting. You don't have to have the original scientist if they can't appear, but a secondary scientist who retests can testify to their own findings, and that's what we have here. We have an independent second translator testifying to her findings about the defendant's statement. Indeed, we also have no evidence of any colloquialism or any idiom that certainly could have been developed. I believe the defendant is from El Salvador. It could have been developed through a discussion with Officer Ventura about her familiarity with any idiosyncrasies of the Spanish spoken in El Salvador, but that just didn't happen. I'll just say a quick bit about the harmlessness error that the Commonwealth raised. I do think that the best and narrowest grounds for this court are to find that no testimonial hearsay from Officer Gomez came in at trial. I think that's the best and narrowest here, but I'll just talk about harmlessness really quick. So the defendant's statements here are not the most probative evidence in the case.
Ms. Lloyd, this is Justice Kelsey. May I interrupt you? You want us to rule on a case of first impression in the Commonwealth with some debatable backdrop of legal concerns, and that may be the best answer, but could it possibly be the narrowest?
Well, I think I'll make my best case for that, Your Honor, which is that I don't think that this court has to engage in that question of first impression. I think that it's very clear from the record that there was no discussion at all of Officer Gomez's statements. So like period stop, the confrontation clause does not apply. And so that is my argument about how it's the narrowest, because you can make a narrow evidentiary holding that this record does not show any evidence or any statements from Officer Gomez that came in, but I certainly understand where the court is coming from with that question. So let's discuss the harmlessness. The defendant's statements here were kind of boiled down to, I was drinking a lot during that time. I would forget. I don't know what happened. They said that it happened, but I don't remember it happened. I apologized. I don't know why I'm apologizing, but I'm apologizing because they said that it happened. And that was pretty much it. But if you look at the other evidence in the case, which of course is the victim's testimony, and while this was a delayed report case, and then it took a while for the defendant to get arrested, this victim's testimony was impeached only in her delay of reporting, basically. There was no impeachment as to really what happened that night. She was consistent. She had no problem remembering. Her story made sense. And so under the Nobrega case, of course, her testimony alone is sufficient. But we don't just have her testimony. We have another independent witness in this case, which is Oscar Canales, the defendant's former coworker, who became aware that the defendant was interested in this victim because he would talk about how much she liked him. He would brag to customers. Then he told Mr. Canales that he planned to go home and have sex with her that night because her mother was not around. She was working. And so that evidence, the victim's statement and Mr. Canales' statement, I would suggest far outweighs any evidentiary value of the defendant's statement, is therefore harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, if that is indeed the route the court finds to be the best and narrowest in this case. I'd love to answer any other questions. Otherwise, thank you so much for your time.
All right, thank you, counsel. You have 1 minute and 59 seconds for rebuttal, counsel.
Yes, Your Honor, Chief Justice. If I could just sort of go back and clarify, I think, a little bit my position. It wasn't my intention to sort of phrase it in any way to sort of back out of what our main argument was on brief. I think we're going to rely on our arguments on brief and reiterate that this is indeed a foundational constitutional issue in terms of the confrontation issue. But if I could just briefly touch on, I'll touch on the last point first and then go back. In terms of the harmless error aspect of this, it wasn't harmless error, because what we have here is if you look at Mr. Cortez Rivas's statements that were introduced, you have the complaining witnesses' statements who were inconsistent. She initially denied it and then came back later and disclosed it. After several months, after she was arrested or taken in by police, after being declared a runaway minor. Plenty of reasons, motivation to potentially fabricate, or a bias, considering that she stated she also wasn't very fond of Mr. Cortez Rivas. And in regards to Mr. Canales, you could say he's an independent, sort of neutral individual, but he wasn't. He acknowledged again after several months when he made the report that he had had a falling out with Mr. Cortez Rivas. So he wasn't neutral. It was definitely something that was impeachable, could have been impeachable even further. But if you take those and then add it to what Mr. Cortez Rivas' statements were attributed as, you definitely don't have harmless error. You have something significant that could corroborate an individual who says he doesn't remember. It's very different from someone, but you don't hear from his statements and are not sure if he necessarily or he's out admitting it rather than denying it. I know I'm strapped for time. I thank the court for its time. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. And we'd ask the court to, we rely on our brief and would ask the court to grant our prayer for relief. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your arguments, counsel. Please call the next case.
Sullivan versus Clark, Director of Virginia Department of Corrections. Brian Jones, Appellant's Counsel. Victoria Johnson, Assistant Attorney General, Appellee's Counsel.
All right, is counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, please proceed.
May it please the court. May it please the court. My name is Brian Jones. I represent Richard Sullivan on appeal of the denial of his petition for writ of habeas corpus out of the Fauquier County Circuit Court. There are two assignments of error before the court this morning. The first deals with ineffective assistance of counsel relating to trial counsel's cross-examination of two of the Commonwealth's witnesses. The second assignment of error deals with the communication of a plea offer and the advice regarding that plea offer. I'll start with the first assignment of error dealing with the cross-examination of Detective Clark and the confidential informant in the case. Trial counsel was alerted before trial that there was a previous uncharged drug transaction involving the defendant and the same confidential informant. Despite that knowledge, trial counsel elicited from Detective Clark highly prejudicial evidence regarding that uncharged drug transaction. It was highly prejudicial because it was the same confidential informant who was involved in that. It occurred at the same location, and it involved the same controlled substance. Trial counsel offered no reasonable explanation for why he did that in his affidavit, and indeed, there is no reasonable explanation for why he would have done that.
Just with the prejudice prong, because
I don't think it's disputed that his cross-examination of Detective Clark Sure. So on the prejudice prong, essentially, we look to whether the strength of the Commonwealth's evidence. And I would submit a couple of issues there. So one important measure of the strength of the Commonwealth's evidence was the fact that at the general district court level, the judge did not even find that there was probable cause to certify a possession with intent to distribute to the circuit court. He only certified a simple possession case. And part of the reason for that was because the confidential informant did not testify, and his anything related to him was not elicited at the preliminary hearing stage. So the case really hinged on the confidential informant's testimony. Another measure, I think, of the strength of the Commonwealth's case was the fact that the Commonwealth acknowledged in an affidavit that they offered a simple possession plea agreement before the preliminary hearing. It is uncommon for, in a case involving distribution of drugs, for the Commonwealth to offer a simple possession plea to a defendant.
In general district court, is that relevant?
Ultimately, though, there was.
Is what happened in general district court?
Well, I think it's relevant as far as determining.
I mean, because all you need is to either direct indict or certify the case. You can hold all kinds of witnesses in reserve or whatever. I'm just not sure I follow. I mean, you have the evidentiary record of trial, and that's the basis on which we determine reasonable likelihood of a different outcome, not plea negotiations in the Commonwealth Attorney's office or whatever.
Well, as far as the evidence at trial, the case really hinged on the testimony of the confidential informant. That is the evidence that that established that the reason that Mr. Sullivan was there in that parking lot was to distribute a controlled substance to the confidential informant. Without that, you simply have officers coming upon Mr. Sullivan in a parking lot of a location where he actually works at, so he has a reason to be there. There's no significant amount of controlled substances. There's two vials of PCP, no other indicia of distribution, no firearms or cash. So I would submit that there was at least some possibility that a jury could have found him guilty of the lesser included simple possession instead of a possession with intent to distribute. had.
This is Justice Kelsey. May I interrupt you with a question? It has to do with the assignments of the of error in this case. The first assignment of error, as I read it, and I want you to correct me if I'm misreading it, addresses the second prong of Strickland, which is prejudice. It does not address the first prong of Strickland, which is performance. So under our established case law, you have to assert all the grounds necessary for the result you're seeking. And obviously that misses one of the two prongs of Strickland. The second question is assignment of error two, which are factual inferences and findings the trial court drew from the affidavits and from the inconsistencies in the habeas petition and the circumstances of the case. And the assignment of error conspicuously does not say that the trial court should have conducted an ore tenus hearing and then made whatever conclusions he or she wanted to make. It just says you disagree with the conclusions. Can you address both of those points and tell me if I'm misunderstanding the assignments of error or too narrowly interpreting them?
Yes, Your Honor. With regard to the first assignment of error, the circuit court ruling only addressed the prejudice prong of Strickland with regard to Detective Clark. The holding from the circuit court assumed, for the sake of argument, that performance was ineffective or defective and went straight to the prejudice prong of that. So that is the reason for the wording of the assignment of error. But also in brief for the appellee's brief correctly notes in page two that the full assignment of error in the petition for appeal was that the circuit court erred in finding that appellant's trial counsel was not ineffective for eliciting from two witnesses testimony about prior uncharged alleged drug transactions. So by referencing in those first few words that counsel was not ineffective, would submit that that covers both, because ineffectiveness is covers both performance and prejudice.
Let me interrupt.
With regard to this,
there, if I may, the sound of error that I'm reading says it's ineffective because the absence of prejudice. So that usually qualifies the nature of the general charge. So I'm just trying to make sure I'm not misreading it. The sign of error, as I read it, says the trial judge made a mistake because he couldn't have said what he said because what he said was prejudice and the defendant can't prove prejudice and I can prove prejudice. Well, you also have to prove poor performance. You have to prove both. So I think logically speaking, if you're not challenging both poor performance as well as prejudice, you've challenged half the issue with respect to Pollard. And then Clark has a slightly different analysis, but putting aside applying the analysis, just tell me if I'm reading the assignment of error too strictly, if you think I am.
Well, I think you are, and I would just point, Your Honor, the wording in the assignment of error that Your Honor is reading is slightly different than the wording in the actual petition for appeal, where the language about ineffectiveness is included. And that would be my argument for why it should be interpreted more broadly to include both the performance and the prejudice for both Clark and Pollard.
So was that just a clerical mistake in reprinting the assignment of error?
I believe so. I'm not sure, to be honest, the explanation for why that there's a discrepancy in the petition and in the brief.
Okay. So on the second question, briefly, because you have so much more to cover, I don't see any assignments of error saying that whatever fact finding the trial court did with the affidavits and the materials, he shouldn't have done any. He should have had an evidentiary hearing first, heard the witnesses, and then decided the case. That doesn't appear to be an assignment of error before us, but correct me if I'm mistaken, please.
No, Your Honor is correct. There's no assignment of error relating to the trial court's failure to hold an evidentiary hearing. And the reason for that, there's a couple of reasons for that is, number one, there's sort of two parts to that second assignment of error. One is the failure to communicate the plea offer. The second is the advice regarding that plea offer, which was which is undisputed in this case, Mr. Sullivan, in his affidavit, on the second paragraph of his affidavit, the last sentence said the trial counsel informed me that he felt we could beat a simple possession or possession with intent to distribute charge at trial because the Commonwealth's evidence on both charges was very weak. Trial counsel does not dispute that characterization. That was ineffective advice. The only part in his affidavit, in trial counsel's affidavit, where he addresses that is on page 4, paragraph 15, where he says, additionally, Mr. Sullivan rejected a plea offer during the preliminary hearing at the General District Court. I discussed the plea offer with Mr. Sullivan before the hearing for probable cause occurred. So he does not dispute that he advised Mr. Sullivan that he felt that they could beat both the both a simple possession felony charge and a possession with intent to distribute felony charge. And that is, on its face, we would submit ineffective assistance of counsel, ineffective advice, similar to the advice in the Loeffler v. Cooper case from the United States Supreme Court, where trial counsel advised his client to reject a plea offer because the victim was shot below the waist and therefore the Commonwealth could not prove that he intended to kill the victim. Here, best case scenario at trial, given the defendant's own statements and the evidence from half a dozen police officers seeing Mr. Sullivan in possession, best case scenario at trial would have been for a jury to find him guilty of lesser included, which would have been felony possession.
Counsel, this is Chief Justice Goodwin. The statement you just made, doesn't that cut against your argument that the that Mr. Sullivan would have accepted the plea agreement if he had known about it? You're saying he relied upon the representation by his attorney that he could beat either a possession or a distribution charge. So why would he take a plea agreement to one of the charges?
Well, the assignment of error also alleges that Mr. Sullivan received ineffective advice surrounding that plea offer. If his attorney would have advised him effectively, then he would have known that the best possible outcome at trial would have been the felony simple possession. But he didn't advise him about that plea offer. And when it was brought to his attention later, he gave him bad advice relating to that, at least according to Mr. Sullivan. Now, the trial counsel doesn't even dispute that he gave him bad advice about that. I mean, he acknowledges, or he doesn't dispute that he told him he felt they could beat a simple possession. So the reason we didn't assign error on the court's decision not to order a evidentiary hearing is because it's clear from the pleadings, which because there's no evidentiary hearing, this court can review de novo, that counsel gave ineffective advice.
So you're not asking us, I'm trying to pull up your brief, but you're not asking us to send it back for an evidentiary hearing. You're asking us to make a decision here that he was ineffective?
That's right.
But the counsel, this is Justice Kelsey again. The problem I have with that is that the trial court made factual inferences from disputed affidavits and inconsistent statements in the petition, and they were clearly factual inferences on both prejudice and performance, primarily on prejudice. Those we typically don't do any facts de novo on appeal. In fact, I can't think of an example where we do that. Now, it's theoretically possible that it could be said that there was enough of a contest on the factual record that it would have been more prudent to have an evidentiary hearing and hear the witnesses live. And often that's the more prudent way. But if that's not the issue before us, this fact finder, just like a trial judge sitting in a plea in bar, is making factual inferences from the evidence. And the principal factual debate was prejudice on assignment of error number two. So, correct my thinking if I'm mistaken from your perspective.
Your Honor, this court's opinion in Zemini versus Clark holds that when a habeas court dismisses a petition based on a review of the pleadings without an evidentiary hearing, we review the decision to dismiss the petition de novo. Where the trial court is ruling just based on affidavits and not hearing live witnesses, there's no reason to give deference because the Supreme Court is in just as well good of a position to review that evidence itself. And that's why there is that's why there's the de novo standard of review when there's no evidentiary hearing.
But the only problem I would ask you to address further is in those cases where we say review of pleadings, that's when the decision is made on a pleading defect. And of course, that's just like a demur. We hear the case de novo because no one's making factual inferences below. But once they do make factual inferences based upon evidence, and an affidavit is evidence, the fact finder, whoever the proper fact finder is, gets an enormous amount of deference. So do you see the distinction that I'm trying to tease out?
I think I do, and I understand when there's hearing where you have live witnesses why that's important, but when it's just decided simply on affidavits that are submitted, this court is in just as good of a position as the trial court to make a determination about credibility because there's no additional evidence to be considered. And that's why I think Zemini v. Clark holds that it's a de novo review, even in the case where Clark clearly says where there's no evidentiary hearing, it's de novo. And that's what was the case in this case.
All right. Thank you, counsel. You have expired your time, so you have no time for rebuttal. Commonwealth.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. Appellee.
I apologize, Your Honor. I was trying to unmute my microphone. Good morning.
I called you by the wrong name anyway.
I knew you meant me. Good morning, Your Honors. This is Victoria Johnson. I'm appearing on behalf of the director. May it please the court. This court should affirm the circuit court's dismissal of the habeas corpus petition in this case for a couple of reasons. First of all, the court properly found that there was not Strickland prejudice as to the cross-examination claim. Second, the court made proper factual inferences on the Lafler claim from affidavits and the trial court record, which is appropriate in habeas. Turning quickly to the first issue, there is an assignment of error issue, procedural default issue in this case that was addressed in earlier argument regarding the testimony of the confidential informant, Pollard. Here, the court at record 154, civil record 154, assumed without deciding deficient performance regarding the detective, but found no deficient performance as to the confidential informant's testimony. And that finding regarding the confidential informant's testimony is not included in the assignment of error before this court because there's been no allegation that separate independent basis, one of the Strickland prongs, was erroneous, then that precludes relief as to the confidential informant claim.
Did I understand, counsel, that opposing counsel indicates that perhaps there is a clerical error in his assignment of error and that he did challenge both?
Well, Your Honor,
petition?
Looking at the petition for appeal, which is what is quoted in the appellee's brief. The appellee's brief drew the assignments of error from the petition for appeal. That first assignment of error, which is at appellee's brief 2 and petition for appeal 4, states the circuit court erred in finding that appellant's trial counsel was not ineffective for eliciting from two different witnesses testimony about prior uncharged alleged drug transactions allegedly involving appellant because appellant cannot prove he was prejudiced. And I submit that language was just drawn from the petition for appeal, narrows the assignment of error to only the prejudice prong. In any event, I submit that there was not Strickland prejudice on this record. As the court knows, the Strickland prejudice standard requires the court to find there's a reasonable probability of a different result absent the alleged error of counsel. Here, three police officers testified regarding Mr. Sullivan's actions that night. Two police officers testified that they could smell the strong odor of PCP emanating from this car. When they approached the car, they saw two vials of the type used to carry or store PCP in his lab. They saw what they described as wet blunt guts, a green substance that was wet in a baggie, also visible. When they had Mr. Sullivan step out of the car, those vials fell to the ground, to the floor of the car. They were recovered, sent to the lab, and found to contain PCP. Mr. Sullivan made inculpatory statements. He told the police that he had gone to Maryland earlier in the day to buy PCP. He spent, I think he said, $100, and I may have that amount wrong. He bought six vials. He planned to sell them for $100 a piece, brought them back to Virginia to sell for $100 a piece. That is consistent with the confidential informant's testimony that he had arranged with the defendant to purchase two vials for $200. It is difficult to see how this other testimony regarding a prior transaction could have affected the outcome in this situation. There was overwhelming evidence. Added to that, and this is something that the circuit court looked at as well, was Mr. Sullivan's own testimony at trial. He took the stand and his testimony was confusing and inconsistent. He said that he just didn't know what happened. He didn't remember what happened. He is familiar with the smell of PCP, but there wasn't any smell of PCP in his car. And that testimony, of course, was not availing to the jury. Another issue regarding the assignment of error that's somewhat interesting in this case is that because the petitioner has not challenged the deficient performance finding regarding the confidential informant's testimony, I think that this court should look at when evaluating this prejudice issue regarding the detective, I think that the court should look to the fact that the confidential informant's testimony regarding this prior bad, this prior transaction is in the record. That's not challenged. It's there. And given that kind of posture of the case, the confidential informant had told the jury about this prior act. And it's difficult to see how this cumulative evidence from the detective, which is challenged, could have any effect on the Strickland prejudice prong. If there's any questions about that first assignment of error, I do have
one question. Am I correct that trial court assumed deficient performance without deciding it?
Correct.
And did decide it on the basis of prejudice. So the one thing that the trial court did, which was to say no prejudice, that is encompassed by the assignment of error. Right.
That's correct. Yes, Your Honor.
But does counsel have to assign error to something the court didn't do? I'm just trying to figure out what was the right answer. Would you have to frame a separate assignment of error saying the court erred in not deciding, failing to rule on the performance prong? And that way that would preserve that? Or is it sufficient to just attack what the court actually did?
I apologize, Your Honor, and I thank you for the question because I've apparently been confusing, and let me correct myself. The court found no deficient performance as to the confidential informant's testimony.
Which is Pollard, correct?
Which is Pollard, correct.
So it was an express finding with Pollard on both performance and prejudice, but there was an assumption with respect to Clark.
Right.
On performance, but a holding on prejudice. And if Pollard comes in because it's not addressed, then that means that Clark is redundant.
Yes, Your Honor. Justice Kelsey just summed that up more directly than I did. And that's
Justice
my answer.
Kelsey. And counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. If there's further questions about the first assignment of error, I'm happy to answer them, but I can move on to the second assignment of error. Regarding the second assignment of error, the circuit court made inferences from the record and from the affidavits of counsel, which is proper in habeas matters under Code Section 801-660 and this court's prior decisions, such as Yates and other decisions cited on brief. Here, there were several reasons that this was appropriate in this case. One of the main reasons is that the allegation was that the Commonwealth offered this alleged plea agreement after preliminary hearing. However, the affidavits are consistent that there was no such offer. There was an offer before the preliminary hearing to simple possession that was motivated by the Commonwealth's desire to keep the confidential informant's identity confidential. However, that offer was communicated and rejected by the defendant. There are several, which is established by the defense attorney's affidavit. There are several reasons that is consistent with the record that are gone through in some detail in the brief. Significantly, the defendant claims that he learned about this alleged uncommunicated offer in a before a pretrial hearing of some kind. However, by the time he was in the circuit court trial, he stated in his not guilty plea colloquy that he was satisfied with his attorney. He never brought this up at all. So that goes towards the factual inferences and the consistency of the record and the consistency of the affidavits.
Ms. Johnson, this is Justice Powell.
Yes, Your Honor.
What would be your position as to the options the court has if on this record, I'm not sure if either of those affidavits give the trial court any clear picture of what happened? But we're not being asked to send this back for an evidentiary hearing. So what is the Commonwealth's position as to what options are before the court?
Well, Your Honor, I think that this court has, the petitioner is asking for the court to make a de novo judgment on the issue. However, I submit that that's not appropriate under the court's case law. Here, as was mentioned in earlier argument, the circuit court made factual inferences from the affidavits and from the record as a whole. And I submit they are supported by the record and proper. But what the court is being asked to do is make a de novo determination in the first instance. And the petitioner is relying on the Zimini case. However, the Zimini case dealt with deficiency in pleading. The issue in that case was that the circuit court determined that the petitioner had not alleged sufficient facts to establish prejudice. This is a different posture. Here, if the petitioner had wanted different factual findings, the proper assignment of error would be to ask for an evidentiary hearing. That wasn't done, and I think it precludes the relief that the petitioner is looking for in this case.
So, Ms. Johnson, it's Justice Kelsey, who has the burden of proof in a habeas petition?
The petitioner, Your Honor.
So, to appeal an adverse ruling, no matter who the decision maker is, wouldn't the appellant have to show that the underlying record, no rational person could come to any conclusion other than he has met his burden of proof?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. And that has not been done in this case because there is, I guess I'm borrowing a little bit of sufficiency language, but the trial courts or the circuit court's determination in this case was supported by the record. And I think that ends the analysis for purposes of the appeal. There was a factual basis. Now, could the petitioner have perhaps developed the evidence more in the circuit court? Perhaps.
But what I was getting at is
no error was assigned to that.
A trial court hearing a bench trial with someone that has the burden of proof could say one or two things in the guy lives. The trial court could say, I don't agree with your evidence. I think the evidence is contrary to your evidence, in which case rule on the merits and he loses. Or the trial judge, as a fact finder or jury, could say, I don't really know what the truth is at all. I just don't know. It's too confusing to me. There's too much back and forth. I'm not confident of my decisions. So wait a minute, who has the burden of proving this? You do? Okay, well, you lose.
Right.
So there's two very different types of responses fact finders can give depending upon who has the burden of proof. Am I right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And here the petitioner did not carry his burden to establish not only that this offer existed and was not communicated, but also failed to carry his burden that he would have been prejudiced, because the petitioner did not establish that, as required by Lafler and Frye, the controlling cases, that the plea agreement would have been accepted, and that the plea agreement would not have been withdrawn by the prosecutor, and that the plea agreement would have been accepted. And there are objective facts leading to those conclusions. Here, the petitioner had 18 prior felonies. He had a 5-year-old child in his car with the PCP, doing a drug deal with this 5-year-old child in the car. And the petitioner, as was mentioned in earlier argument, indicated that he thought that he could beat these charges. He thought that the confidential informant was his friend and was going to testify helpfully for him. That was an incorrect gamble, but that kind of goes against the notion that
you've answered my question. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. If there's further questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I will rest on my brief and ask you to affirm.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Time for rebuttal. There is no time for rebuttal. So thank you, counsel, for your argument.
Thank you.
The court will take a 5-minute recess at this time.
Hey, Bernard.
Oh, just left. Good morning, Madam Clerk.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you.
We're going to need to do a countdown to bring the stream back live.
Okay.
So we'll have, once we have everyone back, and if you want, we'll go ahead and move council in once all of the justices are back in place, and then we'll do a live countdown of the stream, and then we can announce the return or however you want to handle that part.
Yeah, once you do the countdown, why don't you just then call the case?
Okay.
And as soon as you call the case, then I'll let council know who is sitting.
All right, sounds good. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We have 7. All right, I think we're ready to go. If our IT department can go ahead and move in council for the next case, Robert Lofton and Kevin Cosgrove. And then we'll get the stream ready to run.
Okay. Council should be in.
Okay, thank you.
Justice Mims, if you're ready, we can do the countdown.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. All right, we're going to go in 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2.
Kittrell as member of Hurley LLC and others versus Fowler and another. Brian E. Pumphrey, Robert W. Lofton, Megan Gare Hubbard, Stephen G. Pops, Appellants Counsel, Trevor S. Cox, Kevin J. Cosgrove, Appellees Counsel.
Good morning, Counsel. This is Justice Mims. In this case, Senior Justice Millett is sitting for Chief Justice Goodwin, and Senior Justice Russell is sitting for Justice Lemons. Counsel for the appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning, Justice Mims, and may it please the court. My name is Robert Lofton of McGuire Woods on behalf of the appellants. In this interlocutory appeal, my clients ask the court to determine whether the appellees have standing to bring the claims at issue in counts 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 of the second amended complaint. As the court decided last year in Platt, while the petition in this case was pending, the appellees here do not have standing to bring what we have styled as the Hurley claims. The judgment of the trial court should be reversed, the Hurley claims dismissed with prejudice, and the case remanded for further proceedings. This litigation is an interfamily dispute. The patriarch of the family was Walt Sr., and the matriarch was his wife, Margaret. They had 3 children together, Walt Jr., Susan, and Lisa. For ease of reference, my clients were the children of Walt Jr. The appellees, who are the plaintiffs below, are Susan and Lisa, and they are the aunts of my clients. Walt Sr. died in 2006, and he essentially left Walt Jr. in charge of the family business. Margaret died in 2014. Walt Jr. then died in 2017. This litigation began 4 years ago in 2018, when Susan and Lisa sued my clients. The allegations in the operative complaint stem from the death of Susan and Lisa's father, Walt Sr., in April of 2006. The focus of the litigation and the claims at issue in this interlocutory appeal regard the ownership of the family business, Hurley LLC. At the time of Walt Sr.'s death, there were 3 members of Hurley LLC: Walt Sr., his wife Margaret, and their son Walt Jr. Importantly, Susan and Lisa were not members of Hurley LLC and did not have any legal interest or privity with Hurley LLC. As alleged in the second amended complaint, Walt Sr.'s interest in Hurley passed to Walt Jr. Walt Jr. then purchased Margaret's interest in May of 2006. It's undisputed that Margaret's interest in Hurley LLC was not in any trust. It is also undisputed that Susan and Lisa had no legal privity whatsoever with Margaret's interest in Hurley LLC. The transaction between Walt Jr. and his mother Margaret in 2006, what we call the Hurley transaction in our briefing, is the focus of this appeal. And the issue is whether Susan and Lisa have standing to challenge this transaction. As this court has made clear, to establish standing, it's essential for a litigant to show an immediate, pecuniary, substantial interest in the litigation, not a remote or indirect interest. In analyzing whether Susan and Lisa have standing to bring the Hurley claims, it's important to remember that Susan and Lisa, again, were strangers to Hurley LLC and were legal strangers to the Hurley transaction. It's undisputed that the Hurley transaction was an inter vivos transaction between Margaret and Walt Jr. that occurred outside of any trust during the life of and 8 years prior to the death of Margaret, and where Susan and Lisa are not the personal representatives of Margaret's estate. Despite this, the Hurley claims in the second amended complaint focus on alleged harms by Walt Jr. against his mother, Margaret, not against Susan and Lisa. Susan and Lisa claim standing to assert the Hurley claims on two bases. First, as beneficiaries of a trust created by their father, Walt Sr., and second, as beneficiaries of a trust created by their mother, Margaret. Susan and Lisa do not have standing under either theory. With regard to the first theory, and the Walt Sr. Trust, as we argued in our reply brief, Susan and Lisa have not focused on this theory prior to filing their brief of appellees at the merit stage, currently before the court. Thus, I should not be considered for the first time on appeal. But to the extent the court addresses it, Susan and Lisa do not have standing to challenge the Hurley transaction by virtue of their status as beneficiaries of Walt Sr.'s trust for at least two reasons. First, the Second Amendment complaint is clear that Walt Sr.'s interest in Hurley LLC passed to Walt Jr. That's at Joint Appendix page 30, paragraphs 28 through 30 of the Second Amendment complaint. Second, there's no allegation in the Second Amendment complaint that Walt Jr., as trustee of Walt Sr.'s trust, was somehow required to purchase Margaret's interest in Hurley LLC for the benefit of Walt Sr.'s trust, or that the Hurley transaction somehow put Walt Jr. in direct competition with Walt Sr.'s trust. Indeed, if you look at the terms of Walt Sr.'s trust, Joint Appendix pages 72 through 77, especially Joint Appendix page 74, Walt Jr. had the express authority to acquire property such as Margaret's interest in Hurley LLC. He also had such authority as the executor of Walt Sr.'s estate, and that's at Joint Appendix page 56. Thus, in addition to being expressly allowed under the terms of Walt Sr.'s trust, the Hurley transaction was also wholly unrelated to Walt Sr.'s trust. With regard to the second argument that Susan and Lisa have raised, their status as beneficiaries of a trust created by Margaret in 2007, this was a revocable trust that was created a year after the Hurley transaction. There's no basis under Virginia law for unvested contingent remainder beneficiaries of a wholly revocable trust to have standing to challenge an inter vivos transaction made by the trust settler before the trust was even created. Susan and Lisa were complete legal strangers to the Hurley transaction, as evidenced by the fact that the check attached as Exhibit C to the Second Amendment complaint is made out to Margaret personally. Margaret's ownership interest in Hurley LLC was held in her individual name, not in any trust. Additionally, Margaret's sale of her interest in Hurley LLC occurred outside of a trust and before, again, she created this revocable trust. These facts are undisputed. As this court held last year in Platt, the only person who has standing to challenge the Hurley transaction is the personal representative of Margaret's estate. There is no such personal representative. And also prior to Platt, in Rennick, the court said, we've declined to blur the lines between a suit brought by a personal representative and a suit initiated by a beneficiary of an estate. We have noted that the personal representative, not a beneficiary of the estate, is the proper party to litigate on behalf of the state. And that is true even when the personal representative is also a possible beneficiary. With the Hurley claims, Susan and Lisa are attempting to blur the lines. At no point have Susan and Lisa articulated how or why they have standing to bring the Hurley claims under existing Virginia law. At best, Susan and Lisa are unvested contingent remainder beneficiaries of a revocable trust that was created a year after the transaction they seek to unwind. Despite the fact that this litigation has been pending for 4 years, we addressed this in our reply brief, Susan and Lisa now ask for more time and more discovery in order to articulate why they have standing. The trial court below endorsed a rule of law that would confer standing on a trust beneficiary to challenge any transaction entered into by the trust settlor during her lifetime. As we've made clear, and as it's undisputed, Susan and Lisa were legal strangers to the Hurley transaction. They do not have standing to challenge this transaction. The Hurley claims all relate to an attempt to rescind this Hurley transaction, which we've made clear was an inter vivos transaction between Walt Jr. and his mother, Margaret. As this court held in Platt, we would ask you to hold here that the Hurley claims are inherently on behalf of the estate as they would have belonged to Margaret during her lifetime. The judgment below should be reversed and the case remanded for further proceedings. If I may, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Very good, counsel. 5 minutes and 52 seconds.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Cosgrove, you may proceed.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Kevin Cosgrove with Hunton Andrews Kurth, and I represent the appellees Susan Fowler and Lisa Foster. This court should affirm the circuit court's denial of appellant's demur regarding the Hurley counts. The major reason for this is the standard of review that this court has to apply in judging this case. Both parties agree that in order to have standing, a plaintiff must have a personal stake in the outcome of a case. That's undisputed. But where the parties diverge is the required showing of standing at the pleadings stage of a case. The Grisso versus Nolan case at 262 Virginia makes this point quite clear. It says that while the finding of standing is a legal question, that legal question is best answered in the context of full factual determinations. Typically, that occurs after findings of fact have been made by the trial court. That is also, but we're at the pleading stage here, so there are no findings of fact. There are just general allegations. This is also buttressed by the Lujan case that we cite at page 25 of our brief from the United States Supreme Court. There, the United States Supreme Court said that at the pleading stage, general factual allegations of injury may be sufficient to confer standing. Lujan was a standing case where the United States Supreme Court found that the plaintiff lacked standing, but that was in a summary judgment proceeding where there were defined facts and all the facts were none of the facts were reasonably in dispute. But here, we're still at the pleading stage, so a much lower requirement should be required. The facts that would specifically show standing are still being uncovered. Opposing counsel made the point during his argument that this matter has been going on for 4 years, and he's correct about that. The reason it's been going on for 4 years is that the appellants have consistently resisted discovery every step of the way. In order to obtain Walt Sr.'s trust document, we had to file a motion to compel. After we underwent some discovery, the appellants filed a demur to the second amended complaint. When that was overruled, they filed a meritless petition for a writ of certiorari to this court, which took a year before that was finally resolved. And then almost immediately thereafter, they have filed this petition for interlocutory appeal, which has taken another year of this. So the fact that this case has dragged on as long as it has is certainly not the fault of Susan and Lisa Foster. It's the direct result of the defendant slash appellant's obstruction and behavior. So when you go to their reply brief at page 12. This is where the rubber meets the road, if you will, for purposes of this. They state, quote, just as a court must determine whether it has jurisdiction at the outset of a case, a plaintiff should be required to demonstrate at the outset of a case that she has standing to assert her claims before allowing those claims to proceed. And as the cases I've discussed earlier indicate, that's just not the law. Now, we talk about, you know, undisputed facts. And this record closed a couple of months ago. But discovery has continued to go on. And last month, I took the deposition of Hurley LLC. And in that deposition, we learned that Margaret's ownership interest in Hurley LLC, as of 2004, was held in a trust. Now, we have asked for the documents regarding 2005 and 2006. The defendants haven't provided them yet, but we don't know what's going to happen. And to say it is undisputed that Margaret's interest in Hurley LLC was never held in a trust is simply incorrect, as we have recently found out. So discovery is ongoing. We need the opportunity to fully develop the record. If when the record is fully developed, we don't have standing, well and good, so be it. But at this point, at this stage of the proceedings, we certainly should be permitted to proceed, flesh out our claims, and see where they take us. Now, Susan and Lisa, in our brief, have standing in two separate ways. First, Walter Jr. owed fiduciary duties to them as trustee of Walt Sr.'s trust. And we go over that in detail. Walt Sr. died in, his trust was created in 96. He died in 2006. And upon his death at that moment, Walter Jr. owed fiduciary duties both to his mother and his sisters. Instead of acting in the best interest of his mother and his sisters, Walt Sr. woke up Margaret out of a sound sleep one day, 12 or 13 days after Walter's death, told her to sign a piece of paper, which purported to be a sales verification in her own name personally, as opposing counsel pointed out at the start. And she did so because she trusted him implicitly. Now, what we don't know, as I stated a minute ago, is whether or not that stock was in fact held in some trust, some pre-existing trust of Margaret's. Because if it was, then that sale to that sales verification didn't convey anything. But we don't know that yet. We're in the process of trying to figure that out. And insofar as Walter Jr.'s decision to defraud his sisters during the administration of Margaret's trust, we lay that out in pretty much detail in our brief at pages 10 to 11. I'm not going to go through all the sordid details there, but I think it's pretty clear that based on the facts as we have them, he clearly committed breaches of fiduciary duty of loyalty to Margaret, to Lisa, and Susan, and they have standing to assert them. Let me talk about Platt for a second. Platt is factually distinguishable from this case. In Platt, the decedent was a gentleman by the name of Dr. Griffin, and several transactions involving Dr. Griffin during his lifetime were challenged. And the court held that because Dr. Griffin was alive and participated in those challenges, any causes of actions involved in those challenges would have belonged to Dr. Griffin and then to his estate. Therefore, the personal representative was the required party. But here, none of Walter Jr.'s misconduct occurred during Walter Sr.'s lifetime. Consequently, none of them would have passed to Walter Sr.'s estate. Instead, the actions of which Susan and Lisa complain were taken by Walt Jr. when he was trustee of Walt Sr.'s estate. and he then owed fiduciary duties to Walter, to Susan and Lisa and Margaret. And instead of acting in their best interest, for an unbroken string of 13 years, he took every possible effort to defraud Margaret, Susan, and Lisa out of their rightful rightful interest as beneficiaries of the estate. His fraud perpetrated this every step of the way. At page 18 to 20 of the they state that in their brief that there's no Virginia case law on this point. And I will agree that there are no reported cases involving the factual pattern of a trustee who obtains for himself a majority interest in property in which the trust owns a personal interest. That doesn't mean that cause of action doesn't exist or the plaintiff shouldn't be allowed to pursue it. It just means this court hasn't ruled on that particular factual issue. And as we go through our brief, you see there have been a number of jurisdictions that have looked at this precise issue and have said, yes, you are permitted to, you should be permitted to assert this cause of action. At page 5 of his reply brief, they cite a quote from the comments section of the Uniform Trust Code. It said something like the doctrine prohibits the trustee's pursuit of certain business activities and cites a few possible examples. The list was not exhaustive, not all inclusive. And to that list, if the Uniform Trust commentators were confronted with this, they would probably add defrauding the beneficiaries of a trust in order to line the trustee's personal pockets is a type of business opportunity that should be included. We are well on our way to completing discovery in this case. Once we can get back into the circuit court, at that time, we will be in a position to say, here are the complete undisputed facts. But for the other side to sit and say that facts are undisputed now, when they haven't been fully fleshed out, is simply not fair. It's simply not right. This court should reject this premature appeal, and this court should uphold the decision of Judge Shaw and remand this matter back to the trial court so that a full exposition of the facts in this case to determine standing can be understood. I'll be happy to answer any questions, but if not, I thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
Yes, sir. Briefly, Justice Mims. Virginia law is clear that only the personal representative, not the beneficiaries, may bring claims such as the Hurley claims. What Mr. Cosgrove is asking for is a change in Virginia law. A plaintiff should be required to articulate the standing to bring their claims, their standing to engage in discovery so that parties aren't required to defend themselves against claims where ultimately the plaintiff, in fact, did not have standing. Because Virginia law is clear that the personal representative of Margaret's estate is the one who should be bringing these claims, we'd ask you to reverse the judgment of the trial court, dismiss the Hurley claims with prejudice, and remand this case for further proceedings on the remaining claims in the second amended complaint. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, counsel. Clerk, you may call the next case.
Sumner Partners LLC versus Venture Investments LLC. Michael R. Schabelsky, Jonathan L. Calder, Appellant's Counsel, Robert J. Zelnick, Appellee's Counsel.
Okay, Mr. Schabelsky, this is Justice Mims. In this case, we have Senior Justice Millett sitting for Chief Justice Goodwin, Senior Justice Russell sitting for Justice Lemons. You may proceed.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, my name is Mike Schabelsky. I represent Sumner Partners. With me here today is Steve Klebanoff, the owner of Sumner Partners. This court should reverse the portions of the judgment below that denied wholesale three categories of recovery of three categories of Sumner's litigation expenses. Those three categories were first, the attorney's fees and other expenses Sumner incurred and paid in this lawsuit on remand after this court's first decision in the first appeal in this case, called we call Sumner One. The second category were the expenses that Sumner incurred and paid for work by one of its testifying experts at trial, Channing Martin. And the third were expenses incurred and paid for work by another of its testifying experts, Gary DeClark. The reason the court should reverse the denial of the expenses in those categories is straightforward. As the prevailing party, Sumner is entitled under the party's contracts to recover its reasonable litigation expenses. The trial court did not deny wholesale these three categories of expenses because she found them unreasonable. With respect to the first category, the post-remand or remand expenses, she in fact expressly stated that she was not deciding one way or the other whether those expenses were reasonable. Rather, she relied on a mistake of fact and a misreading of the contract. She concluded that they weren't recoverable because those expenses, she thought, were not related to Sumner's lawsuit. That's just wrong. All the expenses of the record documents were incurred for proceedings on the remand, and Venture didn't disagree. Venture never maintained below that Sumner was not entitled to recover under the party's contract expenses on the remand proceedings. With respect to Mr. Martin's fees for Mr. Martin's work, the trial court believed his total amount was excessive. We disagreed, but so be it. But that is no reason then to award zero. The court instead should have determined what was a reasonable amount for Mr. Martin's work and awarded that amount. And she had the means to do it because all his itemized time entries were available. And then with respect to Mr. DeClark's fees, again, the court relied on an inaccurate premise, namely that one of the invoices for his work didn't show what the invoice was for, and that's just incorrect. The invoice plainly stated it was for Mr. Martin's appraisals or valuations, and Mr. Martin, DeClark rather, at trial clearly explained the work he had done. Now, Your Honors, Venture does not seek to defend the reasons the trial court relied on for disallowing these three categories of expenses. It instead just asks you to ignore the reasons and just defer to the trial court's determination in this category. Well, while, of course, a trial court's reasonableness determinations ordinarily are entitled to deference, deference is not a blank check, a carte blanche, to do whatever reason, to deny what fees for whatever reason the trial court wants to give. If the trial court relies on a mistake of fact or an error of law, then that's an abuse of discretion, and that's what happened here. Venture also asked this court to basically act as the trial court and make its own determination that, well, okay, zero should be a reasonable amount for these categories in any event. Now, again, that's at odds with its position below. It didn't say we were entitled to zero. It agreed we were entitled to some fees. They disagreed about the amount, but now they're coming and saying zero, you should decide. But at the end of the day, what they're asking you to do is to act as a trial court in the first instance and to review the record and determine what amount is reasonable. And as much as we would love to not have to, you know, continue with the litigation, those issues have to be remanded to the trial court to make the initial determination. If I can then shift to the question of prejudgment interest, the court should reverse too the trial court's denial of Sumner's request to recover prejudgment interest on its litigation expenses. The trial court abused its discretion in denying that request because its decision was influenced by a mistake of law. And I think that's the only fair conclusion for three reasons. First, strong equities favored Sumner's request. As this court has recognized, prejudgment interest is part of the damages necessary to make a litigant whole. Sumner's request didn't even make Sumner whole. Its request was modest. Although this case has been protracted, has lasted some now 6 years or so, Sumner requested interest only from the date of this court's opinion in the first appeal, even though Sumner had paid most of the expenses and had been out of pocket that money for several years before that. Sumner limited its request modestly and equitably for the commencement with this court's prior opinion, because at that point, Sumner's entitlement to prevail on the merits and to recover litigation expenses was no longer disputed.
Mr. Schabelsky, this is Justice Kelsey. May I ask you this? How does the argument fit within the traditional dichotomy between liquidated and unliquidated damages?
Yes. The claim for litigation expenses would be an unliquidated claim, because at the beginning of the lawsuit, obviously they're not liquidated. But this court has recognized two points. One is that the prejudgment interest statute does allow prejudgment interest on liquidated claims. That was first recognized as early as Beal v. King in 1963. And second, this court has said that certainly in the ordinary case, prejudgment interest is not appropriate when the claim is unliquidated and disputed. And that's why we limited the request to the commencement of prejudgment interest starting with the Sumner 1 opinion, because from that point, the claim for entitlement to attorney's fees was no longer disputed. And so we think this fits very comfortably and consistently, Your Honor, with the court's prior rulings on the treatment of liquidated claims under the statute.
So can I also ask you this? So on the, I get the contested versus non-contested distinction post Sumner 1. Are the fees and costs actually in fact liquidated after Sumner 1? Because the bills are there. It's not that the decision maker has to determine whether the bills were incurred. The only question is the decision maker has to determine whether the amount is reasonable.
Right.
So how does that factor, the liquidated versus unliquidated thing, apply to this very unique context?
Right. Well, Your Honor, yes, the quantum of attorney's fees was not liquidated upon the issuance of Sumner 1, but that is no different than any other claim, an unliquidated claim that the statute clearly allows prejudgment interest can be attached to. And here we have the added factor, which is another equitable consideration, Your Honor, was that, as the record shows, Sumner promptly gave all of its itemized billing statements and expenses to Venture. I think it was within 1 month or 6 weeks of this court's ruling, and said, here's the amount. And so Sumner, you know, could have stopped the clock, so to speak, on the accruing of interest by paying at least the undisputed portions of the attorney's fees. But if your question, Your Honor, is going to the point where you can't start in prejudgment interest until the claim has been liquidated, I think that's not,
but there's a bias, there's a judicial bias favoring the prejudgment interest award when it's clearly liquidated, and there's clearly a bias against that, although there's no prohibition. So you're right, there's discretion, but if you get dropped into the discretion zone on that issue, you likely lose.
Well, except, Your Honor, if the discretion is based, if the exercise of discretion is based on a mistake of law, and that's not so. That's what's happened here. Because if we talked about the compelling equities for Sumner, Venture offered no competing equity why prejudgment interest would be unfair to it. For example, it didn't claim it had financial hardship. Quite to the contrary, it talked about all the assets it had. The sole reason Venture gave, and the sole reason on the record before the trial court for denying the prejudgment interest was a mistake of law, namely the argument that the statute prohibits a prejudgment interest on an unliquidated claim. And so,
right. So, assume for the sake of argument, you're right on that. We're really judging the trial court's decision as opposed to the arguments of Venture. So, we as you know, we presume when there's silence by the court that any logical, rational basis for the exercise of sound judgment, if it can be inferred from the record, we typically infer it. So, would this record not permit the silent determination by the trial court that, in the context of this battle royale, prejudgment interest post 701 is really not warranted from a discretionary point of view?
I don't think that would be a fair outcome, Your Honor, because what this record shows is equities in favor of Sumner, no offsetting negative equities or equities in favor of Venture. And the only consideration that the record shows that the trial court had was an erroneous legal proposition. I mean, unless the court was going to otherwise say, any time a trial court doesn't articulate a reason for a ruling on a matter that's reviewed for abuse of discretion, that is just automatically approved. I mean, this court has never approved rubber stamping discretionary decisions by trial courts.
I'm following you on that, but a lot of times litigants will make an argument to a chancellor or, for that matter, to an appellate court, and we're thinking, well, I don't agree with that, but I still have discretion, and for my own discretionary reasons, I'm going to pick X or Y or Z as the right answer. So I'm pushing back just a little bit about the necessary inference between the argument being made and the probability that the trial court, who could have ruled on a legitimate basis, necessarily ruled on the illegitimate basis. That's what I'm trying to tease out on that assignment of error four.
Well, I think each case obviously has to be assessed on its own facts and the record that is presented. And if, you know, a number of arguments are presented to a trial court judge, obviously the trial court judge can pick and choose, doesn't mean it has to rely at all. But when you look at this record, there is nothing overt or implicit in this record that provides an equitable basis for the trial court to have exercised discretion against Sumner other than the erroneous legal argument advanced by Venture. And okay. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve the balance for rebuttal.
Very good, counsel. 2 minutes and 13 seconds. Mr. Zelnick.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Robert Zelnick, and I represent the appellee in this case, Venture Investments LLC. The arguments made both in brief and today by Sumner Partners in this appeal are not supported by the record in this case, and are not supported by the law. And the judgment of the trial court should be affirmed as to the award of litigation expenses. I would start off when I say that the arguments are not supported by the record, that in the appellee's brief that we filed in this case, we have more than 5 pages of citations showing misstatements and omissions from the record and the statement of facts that are part of the appellant's opening brief. And they're listed there, and each one of those misstatements or omissions is cited to the record and cited to the joint appendix.
Sumner wants- Mr. Zelnick, this is Justice Kelsey again. Would you go ahead and get right into assignment error one and explain again, we've read your briefs, of course, why it is post-appeal fees are not recoverable. Obviously, a case on remand is still the case that existed prior to remand. So the trial judge's statement seems to be very difficult to understand.
Your Honor, we don't dispute the fact that ordinarily the fees after remand would be recoverable. What we contend is that the appellant here is relying on that one clause or statement made by the trial court taken out of context, and that the reason that the trial court denied the post-remand litigation fees is because, as we argued consistently throughout this case after remand, is that the fees and costs post remand were unreasonable and unnecessary and were a result of the litigation tactics that were unsuccessful and asserted by Sumner Partners in this case.
So all of the fees after the order remand, every single hour billed to the file by this litigant is per se unreasonable?
Under the facts and circumstances under this case, yes, Your Honor. What happened in this case is, as the court knows, this was a suit brought by Sumner for specific performance. And what we think is key is the, from the very beginning, once this court remanded the case, Sumner abandoned their claim that they wanted to purchase the property and instead simply asked the court, the trial court, to enter an order saying that they have prevailed on their claims and they are not required to have any deadlines or any time frame set to do the investigation, to perform the remediation work, or to perform, or to actually go to closing. And that's set forth clearly in the final order and judgment that Sumner submitted. It's found at Joint Appendix 45. And what they asked for in this draft or sketch order simply is judgment is entered in favor of Sumner Partners on the claims in its complaint and on Venture Investments counterclaims. Sumner Partners is allowed to enter on the property that is the subject of the agreement to purchase it, to perform the condition satisfaction work, and following completion of the satisfaction work, to close on the purchase of the property and deduct the cost of the work from the purchase price. There's no time frame set for any of that. So from the very beginning, we opposed that, and we asked the court to set deadlines and a time frame for Sumner's performance. That is the relief they asked for in their complaint, that they be allowed to do the remediation work and go to closing to purchase the property. Every hearing and all the work that was done subsequent to Mr. Schabelsky's filing that motion and seeking entry of that order resulted from the fact that the trial court agreed with Venture Investments' position in this case that the deadline should be set, that a time frame should be set, that the court should retain jurisdiction in order to pursue the conclusion of the case and allow the purchase of the property and the closing to finally take place. We cite in our brief the fact that the court noted in its opinion letter that Sumner's position was if we were not satisfied, if Venture was not satisfied with the remediation work or with the failure for them to go to closing, Venture could file a separate lawsuit. We did not want to have to go through that procedure. So we objected to that. The court ruled in our favor on that. And then every single hearing after that was a result of Sumner's efforts to get the court to reconsider its rulings, to modify its rulings, to revise its rulings. And after the court set the agreed that the attorney's fee should be awarded at the conclusion of the case, then Sumner asked that the court sua sponte, ruled that we asked the court simply to award the attorney's fees at the conclusion of the case when the matter had gone to closing. The court sua sponte entered an order saying that the court would consider it after the closing had taken place. We did not request that relief. And at that point, Sumner filed its motion asking the court to escrow the entire amount of the attorney's fees that it wanted. So I can honestly say that other than the from the very beginning, the motion that Sumner filed in this case was not successful, and every effort that was made and all the work that was done in order to pursue their posture that attorney's fees should be awarded upfront, an order simply should be entered terminating the case, and they would be under no obligation with any court order to pursue closing. And that was the essence of the entire proceedings post-remand.
Counsel, has your argument complete? Have you completed your argument?
No, Your Honor. I mean, there's okay. The other portion. I didn't know if that did satisfactorily, although I went on for quite a bit.
It appears that you answered his question, so you may proceed.
Okay. It is well established by this court's rulings that the trial court is supposed to determine what is reasonable and necessary, and also a litigant is only entitled to recover attorney's fees for matters for which they were successful. We believe the record in this case is clear that A, that Sumner was not successful on the claims that it was asserting throughout the post-remand proceedings, and B, that Judge Willis, her one ambiguous statement aside, stated on several occasions that she had reviewed all of the billings that had been submitted. She reviewed the application, she reviewed the affidavits filed by Sumner in support of their application, and she had considered the all of the factors that were required by this court's decision in the Burger Busters case. So she stated that she had considered all those things and that it was her job to determine what is reasonable and necessary. And then she made her ruling. So I don't believe that the one statement that Sumner's argument really relies on completely is an adequate basis, and it is contradicted by or undercut by all of the other statements that the trial court made in this case as to the work she had done. Remember, we had two hearings on the question of litigation fee, the award of litigation expenses. And after the first hearing, Judge Willis took the matter under advisement, and then we had the second hearing. And she stated very clearly that she had reviewed everything in detail, and although she did not give a detailed explanation for her rulings, I believe that the case law is clear that this court is supposed to accept the trial court's representation that that she has in fact considered all of the factors that were required under Burger Busters, and that she had given consideration to the submissions that were made by Sumner. It was interesting with respect to the pre-remand expenses. It is interesting that today Mr. Schabelsky, for the first time, concedes that Channing Martin's fees might be excessive. Throughout his brief, matter of fact, on page 17 of the opening brief, it stated otherwise. It states that the trial court's only complaint about Mr. Martin's fees is that they were, quote, a little high. And we have pointed out clearly that that is, at the very least, ironic understatement by the trial court, that the trial court actually said in two occasions that she was shocked by the amount of Mr. Martin's fees and that she did not find them credible. Looking at the joint appendix at 337, she said, I looked at his bills. It was a little beyond believable. I'm going to try to be generous and kind, but I was shocked. And at that point, counsel, we pointed out that Mr. Martin's bills had been delineated, and Judge Willis responded, they were delineated, possibly not believable, but delineated. And that's it, again, at the joint appendix 337. So
what was counsel, Justice Kelsey, what was the trial judge saying, that not a single dollar billed by Martin was legitimate? Or was the judge saying, I think it's high given what you were presenting? Because that's their whole argument, is you can't walk away from a debate like that with nothing, unless, of course, the finder of fact thinks this whole thing is totally inappropriate, should not have been charged at all.
Well, I believe that ultimately she found that what was submitted by the burden is on the party seeking the award to provide sufficient evidence to justify an award. And what the trial court was saying is she did not find what was submitted on behalf of Mr. Martin to be credible and therefore sufficient to make an award of any sort. That is a failure in the presentation of evidence by Sumner Partners. They could have presented additional evidence, because matter of fact, the trial court brought that out at the very first hearing on litigation expenses that we had when she took the matter under advisement. So Sumner had plenty of opportunity to file supplemental affidavits or supplemental documentation to support the claim, and they failed to do so. So the trial court is, if the trial court feels that it is not credible, then the trial court within its has the discretion, and it's proper for the trial court to disregard the bill that was submitted. The fact that the trial court did not provide detailed explanations obviously is not a basis to overturn the decision. There is no requirement in the law that the trial court provide detailed reasonings for its decisions. It is sufficient, certainly in this case, where she pointed out that she had, in fact, given serious review and consideration to everything that had been submitted by Sumner, and that she had further awarded what she thought was appropriate, which cannot be forgotten was a substantial amount of money, $278,000. She was the trier of fact, and under well-established principles in the Holmes versus L.G. Marion case, this court stated that the trial court is supposed to use its own experience and knowledge when it acts as the fact finder in order to make an award. And that was what we had argued, and that's what we believe the trial court did. She looked at the submissions, was familiar with the case, had handled every aspect of it, and used her own experience and knowledge and made an award that was fair and reasonable under the facts and circumstances of this case. That is the standard to be applied. Briefly, with respect to the question of prejudgment interest, I would certainly echo what Justice Kelsey said earlier, that there's the distinction, and we cite in our brief that this court has long recognized that prejudgment interest is not allowed on unliquidated damages. And on top of that, I would note that Sumner Partners has not been able to cite one case, whether in Virginia or anywhere in the United States, where a court has made an award of prejudgment interest on attorney's fees. They haven't cited, certainly the Virginia Supreme Court has not done so. They did not cite one circuit court case from Virginia, and they have failed to cite a case from any other jurisdiction in the country. So we think that the established procedure where the court makes the distinction between liquidated and non-liquidated, and certainly in this case where the trial court has the discretion to make the determination as to whether or not to award prejudgment interest, that there is no basis for concluding that the trial court abuses discretion. I'd be happy to answer any questions. If the court has none, I would simply ask that the judgment of the trial court be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zelnick. Mr. Schabelsky, you have 2 minutes and 13 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you. I would like to make three brief points about the post-Sumner 1 remand expenses. First, counsel's argument today that all of those expenses are per se unreasonable is at odds with its position below. Below, it did not argue that they were all per se unreasonable. It agreed at least about half or so. It didn't have any objection about. So they've done an about face on that now. Second, the reason for their purported reason for their about face is wrong. To say that we did not succeed on anything belies the record. There were three issues that were the subject of the remand, and we won on them all. The first would be whether the order, the specific performance decree, would impose a hard and fast and variable deadline for completion of the remediation work, which was at odds with the contract. We won on that, and the court retained jurisdiction to extend the deadline accordingly. Second, was getting liquidating the fee amount, as Judge Kelsey pointed out, and we obviously got a substantial amount for the other categories. And the third was an order requiring those fees that we were awarded to be deducted from the closing instead of us having to chase them in a post-lawsuit proceeding. And we won on that too. But in any event, all those arguments Mr. Zelnick is making are matters for the trial court to decide on remand, not here. And the third point I want to make is discretion and deference doesn't mean you ignore the reason the court gave for her ruling. Her ruling that these expenses she thought weren't related to the lawsuit is not some stray random remark in the record. It is part of her ruling from the bench that got incorporated into her final order. And that was an erroneous basis for the ruling. And then finally, with respect to Mr. Martin, all I can say is the court admitted his testimony as relevant. This court relied on his testimony in Sumner 1. It clearly is not per se unreasonable expense for the witness who decided this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. The court is adjourned. The justices will please remain in the virtual courtroom.
Council, please disconnect. Thank you.